Pippa Hudson. Lines are always open on 021-446-0567.
So some pretty major politics happening after 2 o'clock today, but some pretty significant stuff happening in the first hour as well. Another really important issue for this country, particularly to be reflected on during Women's Month, being the scourge of domestic violence. We know South Africa has one of the highest incidences in the world of this crime. We know that every single day in this country, women are assaulted, women are raped, women are sometimes murdered by their intimate partners. And today we've invited a panel of different guests to chat to us about some of the aspects of this scourge, talking about the forms that such abuse takes, talking about some of the reasons that play into women staying in those relationships longer than you might expect them to, and also talking, very importantly, about how to support those who are trying to break free. We're delighted to welcome in studio Siham Samai, Director at the Women's Legal Centre. Welcome back, I should say. Great to have you with us again.
Thank you for having the Women's Legal Centre.
And a very, very warm welcome back to two members of the team from Nontleba Family Counselling Centre in Khayelitsha, who we've spoken to often before, but it's always a pleasure to have you back. Pauline Perez and Nozuko Konjua, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Susan.
And we're going to be dialing in on the line in a few minutes, Claudia Berger, who is herself a survivor of an abusive relationship. She's the program manager of the NGO Annex, which is focused on preventing human trafficking. Also, a little bit later on in the show, we'll speak to Robin Farrell of the First for Women Foundation, because they've done some recent research talking to women who have escaped abusive relationships, escaped situations of domestic violence. And there were some quite interesting findings that I'd like her to talk us through, particularly about the financial element to the conversation. Before we get to any of that, though, Siham, we hear estimates that the number is anything between 1 in 6 women, 1 in 4 South African women, the Justice Department says it might be that high, who are survivors or still living through domestic abuse. Do you think those figures are accurate?
Well, I think one of the challenges that we have is that those are the actual reported ones. Mm. And that there is still a lot of women that is still out there that don't understand the purpose of the Domestic Violence Act, and I would even say the Protection of Harassment Act, or what acts are there to be able to assist them to get a particular order. And the challenge that we're sitting with is that, but even with those numbers that is coming before the court, the number of withdrawals is also still very high. And that is where we see the impunity, that perpetrators are actually not either being found guilty when it comes to the end of that, the end of the criminal justice system. Mm. And that's the other challenge that we have, which is on two levels. People that don't report and those that do report, where the criminal justice system is not effective to be able to assist those women through the actual system.
Mm. I'm going to want to talk to you in some detail about particularly protection orders and who can apply for them and what the process is. But the reason why it doesn't come through the criminal justice system effectively is often a case of the charges being dropped by the victim herself. We know that obviously it's a family relationship we're talking about here. It's fraught with all kinds of emotional layers to it. It's fraught with stigma and shame, and a lot of it though comes down to the psychological condition of the women involved. And I want to bring in Nozuko on this, because I think as the person who really works at grassroots level with this problem, you can probably speak to us about even if the abuse is not taking physical form, many women find themselves beaten down psychologically. Is that correct?
Yes. The challenges that we almost encounter on a daily basis when we're dealing with the women, we know that there's different forms of domestic violence. People are always talking about the ones that we can see, the physical ones and the verbal abuse. But there's this one that it hurts to such an extent that people, they don't know that it exists. Meaning go to the psychological abuse. Mm. Psychological abuse, it looks more into the emotions of how the person feels. You know, when they are, when the women that we work with are presenting their cases, you find out that there is traumas that they went through. Mm. And then being in that relationship, some of them went into the relationships because for certain reasons, they were running away from problems in their own homes. Some, they were forced into the relationships. So once they are there and then they don't have any other support families that they can go to. And then there's issues that, like in our culture, if you married and then you go to to get married, you don't come back. So even if the situation is that bad, you have to stay there. Even if you go to your mother-in-law, they will say, no, my child, everything's going to be fine. So now, if you look into that, that is abuse on its own, because the women that we think that are going to be able to assist us in terms of curbing domestic violence, they are also perpetrating it. Because by the mere fact that you tell a person that you must stay, now everything will be fine. And whereas emotionally, psychologically, physically, financially, you're not in it, in a good state. So then women would stay into that. So our role, partly at Nongeba, is to also offer counseling. Counseling to the women themselves, counseling to the next of kin, the people that are supportive to their growth, to their well-being, like looking also into the children involved in those relationships, also families and the perpetrators themselves, because we need to bring them in so that they can be able to understand what they are doing. Because someone will say, no, I didn't do anything. Like, because they always think that being in a domestic violence relationship is about being having a scar or being pushed. But when you talk about now the emotional, psychological that the women go through, it's which might lead into stress and depression. So I think that is one of the key issues that now we tend to forget about looking in them.
You know, we tend to forget, and it takes sometimes somebody speaking out and sharing their story to remind us. And I just want to point our listeners, if they haven't yet read this piece, to a column that was shared on the Daily Maverick within the last week or two by politician Refilwe Ntseke. She's the DA's national spokesperson and the deputy federal chairperson. And she wrote a very, very frank description, coming up publicly as a survivor of domestic abuse that took psychological and verbal form, speaking very frankly about why she stayed, what she went through. And I just want to read, for those who haven't read that entire article, something of what she said, because to me it spoke volumes about the mindset of a person living in this abuse. She says, the years passed, I lost my self-confidence. I was already a politician, a ward councillor, and the more successful I became in my career, the more he trampled on my confidence. I would bury myself in my work and my children. I became very good at that, smiling, but dying on the inside. Everything he said and did seemed to be aimed at destroying my self-image, to make me feel worthless. My cooking was ridiculed. My body was ridiculed. Nothing I did was ever right. Many people asked me why I didn't leave him. I wanted to so many times, but he had convinced me that I was an embarrassment. Pauline, I can see you nodding your head, and sadly, yes. That's textbook stuff. It's the mental, psychological breaking down of a person's belief in their own worth, that they're worthy of having something better.
Absolutely. So the women come to us and they're completely broken down. They don't believe that they can get out of that situation. They have no value. They don't value themselves. And so they don't believe that there's something better for them. So they stay. They stay for the children. They stay because economically they're not independent. In Xhosa culture, the community that I serve, in Khayelitsha, for instance, and in Xhosa culture, problems within a marriage or within a family get dealt with within that family. So telling people about the Domestic Violence Act and telling them that there is another way out, they don't even believe that that's the path that they should take, because the people that are supposed to be supporting them are not supporting them. So even a mother or a mother-in-law will, even though they know that this is happening, there's no support and nothing basically encouraging the person to move away from that relationship. Yeah.
I want to bring in at this point Claudia Berger, who's been listening to us. Claudia Berger from Annex, the NGO that deals with human trafficking, does fantastic work in that particular field. Claudia, welcome to our panel this afternoon. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
You have your own story of surviving abuse that I know you share and share widely, because what Pauline's just flagged is something you're passionate about communities and people offering support structure to those who are going through abuse, and the importance of their role in combating the scourge.
Yes, definitely. And I couldn't agree more with the politician who wrote about why she stayed. I think that one of the biggest reasons, if I look at my own history of domestic violence, is that, you know, you know that people will add to the shame that you already feel. you allow stuff to happen to you, which you won't. I mean, now looking back at it, I'm appalled. And in your marriage, you feel appalled by yourself because the person who inflicts the violence is like a tsunami. You don't know when to expect what. Now, I was abused in every possible way besides physical. It was going that way.
Mm.
So you, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you start asking yourself, what do I need to prepare myself for tonight for? And you cannot explain to people who's not find themselves there because it's not a logical process. I mean, I'm a qualified social worker and I've worked with these things before. And I think the day that I went to apply for my protection order was probably the worst day in my life. But the day that they came to deliver the protection order or served it on him was also the day that I claimed my power back. And it's not something that you can explain logically and rationality because there's no rationality behind that. If you understand how trauma works in the brain, you're absolutely in survival mode 24/7.
Mm.
And you literally like victims, other victims of trauma. You allow things to be done to you. I mean, I was forced to have sex in the most unpleasant ways in the middle of the night, and you allow it because you just want to have peace. But the peace is, it's not peace because, I mean, they're never satisfied. You never write. They isolate you from everyone. And, I mean, I can write a whole life story about this.
Mm.
And only when you understand why women later on feel, I mean, you live for the 2 seconds when they're sort of nice. Because, I mean, we've also been raised in a culture. I was raised in a culture. You don't leave. You always treat the man with respect.
Mm. Claudia, in your case, a protection order was issued. Did it work for you? One of the complaints that we hear often from women who is that they tried getting a protection order and it simply wasn't effective. It didn't make any difference. In your case, did it offer you protection?
Well, I must first of all say that the first time I went to the Department of Justice offices in Plain Street in Cape Town, and I was treated in the most horrendous way by the women there. She sat there with a cup of coffee. She was more interested in that. And when I told my story, she said to me, so what do you want? Mm. And I said, well, he needs to be removed off the premises. And she and her supervisor told me at that stage that I cannot get a protection order until he physically assaults me. Now, I mean, I had someone with me who works in the sector, a colleague of mine who knows the Domestic Violence Act backwards, frontwards. And in that moment, I completely lost it. I think if it wasn't for Caroline that was with me, I would have turned the whole office upside down. So we went back to South Kibatman, where our offices was, and I was helped by Charmaine, who was the legal officer at South Kibatman, who took all, I mean, I had 5 pages of evidence written of incidents that happened. She took all of that, and through South Kibatman, I managed to get the protection order. Yes, he did. And he didn't turn up for the protection order hearing. And the judge said to me, don't worry. He signed that he received the interim order. So she made the order permanent. So even though we got divorced 5 days after the order was served on him,
mm-hmm.
I've got a permanent protection order against him.
Okay.
And he's not, well, unless I don't know about it, he's not attempted to come near me after that.
Okay, so in your case, it did work, but it took a great deal of effort. I mean, Sihama, I saw you shaking your head when Claudia made that comment that she was told you cannot get a protection order until he has assaulted you. Surely that can't be right.
Yeah, can I? I mean, I was shaking my head because one of the issues that we have at the Women Legal Center is this issue of secondary victimization.
Mm.
You must probably have seen it takes a huge amount of strength for a woman to come through a society that is patriarchal, that is within an environment which takes a huge amount of effort and to get to the particular court. And then when you are there, then you have to go through insensitive behavior. You have to deal with people that don't understand. And it's what we call victim blaming.
Mm.
And as lawyers, I mean, we're only dealing with the component where we're in the criminal justice system. And we are asking, for example, why can't these people go to Department of Social Development before? Because for us to place this woman within a criminal justice system, knowing that there will be secondary victimization, for us, it's worse because we need to be able to protect them. And that's, it's important to go to an institution like Sarki Bartman that can protect you from the victimization of the clerks, etc. Then you also have, I'm just pushing it up there, but Legal Aid South Africa, for example, that does not provide legal services to women in terms of first-time applications.
Really?
No, it's only when it's defended. So, which is really, you need to understand the psychology of a survivor, I would say, because it is a survivor. Somebody that gets through the community into the criminal justice system is already a survivor. Mm. And we need to, because it's no longer, they took that step. But then you need a person, like a legal person, to go through the actual application. Now, you have your clerks. That is supposed to help you with completing the form. But then they don't understand what is imminent danger. Whereas the Act says, if there's imminent danger, that the person needs to be removed from the household.
Mm.
And then it can be interim, and then you can come back. You know, to do, so it's an interim order, you get the return date, and then they can come argue. But the person needs to be removed. And that is why... Is the challenge is that if the clerk doesn't know what is interim danger, or they don't give you interim monetary relief, because that is some of the challenges. Mm. Who's going to pay my bond? Mm. Who's going to pay the school, the kids' school fees? Who's going to pay the groceries? There is a process, there's an order that can be given, which is an interim monetary relief. And the clerks is supposed to explain this to the women, so that they can avoid this, what I call secondary victimization.
Can I tell you something? In all the years of broadcasting and news reporting, that's the first time I've ever heard the fact that there is a financial relief offered as part of this process. Yeah. And that alone, given how much research and just how many discussions like this I've had, tells me that we're missing something here in the communication, firstly to women about what their rights are, but secondly to the people working within the system about how to handle these cases when they come before them. Because that is one of the big questions many women face, is if I am going to take steps against the person who's the primary breadwinner in the house, what becomes of those of us left in the house who are not earning? Mm-hmm. And how do we survive? You're saying to me that the law actually makes provision
yes,
for that.
Yes, I'm actually going to read the provision. Please it do. Says the court may order the respondent to pay emergency monetary relief having regard to the financial needs and resources of the complainant and the respondent, and such order has the effect of a judgment. Now, I mean, this is in there. It's the court's powers in respect of protection orders. And I think maybe, like I said, I mean, the psychological impact of somebody going through the system, a woman's first priority, I mean, it's obviously, it's also her children. And I think these are the challenges that we have, is that we need to look at the seriousness of the conduct. And there is a chronic, you know, this is where there's a chronic inability of the criminal justice system to be able to deal with survivors of domestic violence. It is not your normal criminal case. You need to deal with this woman in a much different manner. Mm. And the system needs to work. Which is, you need your social workers there to be able to strengthen that woman. You need the lawyer there, because sadly, there's a Domestic Violence Act where there's laws. You need to present evidence, etc. And then you have a, for example, Legal Aid South Africa that doesn't provide.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because they don't want to. They think that there is a system that works.
Meanwhile, we're hearing
that we are saying that it's not working.
Mm-hmm. We have to take a pause for the news headlines. We're going to carry on the conversation after that with our guests in studio, focusing on domestic violence this hour. And Terence has posed a very important question on the SMS line about who these abusers are and what a so-called typical victim looks like. It's something we'll come back to after the news headlines. But first, let's get an update from Amy McIver.
Pippa Hudson on Cape Talk. Call Pippa on 021 446 0567.
We continue our panel discussion on domestic violence. We're getting multiple messages on all of our channels indicating that there is once again a problem with the Cape Talk signal. Our apologies for that. We have flagged it with our IT department to follow up with Centec. It is not a Cape Talk generated problem. It's something in the signal distribution network that is recurring. I would advise you, if you're able to in the meantime, please either tune into DSTV channel 885, where you'll find the Cape Talk feed. You can stream online on our website, capetalk.co.za, or if you've downloaded the Cape Talk app, you can listen, of course, on your cell phone. So please, as an alternative, while we get that sorted out, please use one of those. I really don't want you to miss this conversation, nor do I want you to miss, obviously, our live coverage of the vote of no confidence after 2 o'clock. So please try one of those alternatives for the meantime, and I hope that they're able to sort out the issue with Centec as quickly as possible. Now, a very important, I think, SMS came in from Terence just before we broke for news, and this is what Terence asks. Who are these men? Are they normal at the family braai? Are they normal at work? Are they normal at church? Are they normal in society? And Terence, I think you've hit the nail on the head, because there is no such thing as a typical perpetrator or a typical victim, is there, Pauline?
No, there's no such thing. Because the women who come to our centre, certainly the partners or the abusive partner, they come from different, they're white, they're black, they're professionals, they're non-professionals. And so there's no such thing as a typical perpetrator.
Yeah. I want to bring Claudia back in here, because Claudia, I know this is an issue you are particularly strong on talking about, that really very often you'd be surprised at what's happening behind closed doors.
Yeah, I think that what often happens, and I mean, I've seen it in my instance and in women that I know that have similar circumstances, is that, you know, there's no way, as Pauline said, to know who the perpetrators are. You cannot go to a lot of people and say, oh, those men are. My ex-husband in particular, you know, he would be well-loved and liked in a crowd, but if you get to know him better, you would immediately sense, I mean, he had very clear narcissistic traits, which I only picked up in the years that we were married, and would be fine at a braai, but later on also not even that, because you didn't dare go with him anywhere. I mean, they would isolate you from anyone, and it was the big element is around control and the things that they will do to make sure that they control every move of you. They want to control every thought of you. They want to control everything about you. And I just want to come back to the first point about going to the court. You know, I said the day that I went to the court, I said that he's already threatened how he's going to kill me. Mm. And that was not even enough for them. So again, it's exactly as the one lady said, what does imminent danger mean? And it's also for everyone, imminent danger is a different thing. If you live under psychological threat every day like I did, that enough for me is to believe that your life is always in danger. And how do you protect you and your children from that? For me, just having to go to the Department of Justice, I twice went to the office in Plain Street, where I turned around and I couldn't go through with it. Mm. And I mean, I know he presented himself, even when I eventually filed for divorce, as, oh, I'm the one to be blamed. I'm the one now that met. I mean, he went to my family at a meeting with my daughters. Thankfully, he's not their father. He had a meeting with other people. I am now the one who's always to be blamed. And unfortunately, even though I'm a social worker, it got to the point where later on I thought, well, maybe I am the one that's always to be blamed. Mm. So you don't even want to be in company with him and other people anymore, because you don't know what's going to come out.
Yeah, Claudia, I mean, there are lots of people responding to your story on our email and SMS with just simple outrage. I mean, here's a message from Karen on Facebook saying, it makes me furious to hear how women, who should be most understanding in their work role, not to mention as members of the same sex, can make the lives of victims more difficult. Her comment is, patriarchy knows no gender. And I think it's a very apt one for this conversation. Those are sentiments that are being shared by many people. as to why the system isn't working as it should. Siam, is it an issue of not enough training and engagement being done by the people who are at the coalface dealing with survivors on a daily basis?
Well, one of it, yes, I think one of it is training, but it's not your normal training. It needs to be broader sensitization around what is the psychology of a survivor and how is it the type of support that they are supposed to give to these women. But it's also that the different departments need to work together. The Domestic Violence Act speaks to an integrated approach. So if you have a clerk also that sits there that has to deal with the trauma of a person that don't, and they don't even know, they are also traumatized within that particular process. Then you have it going through the system, and you have a magistrate, you have a maybe a prosecutor, if it's within the criminal justice system, all need to be sensitized to be able to understand the psychology. So it is also training, but there needs to also be a willpower in the criminal justice system to give priority to domestic violence. It's not just about the numbers. It's about ensuring that the perpetrators are caught at the end of the day, that there needs to be change. There needs to be some form of accountability. And I think this is where Parliament also, that these oversight roles that Parliament, the executive, etc., needs to play. And not just to look at the numbers, they need to ask the questions in terms of change.
I just wanted, for the sake of those who might have come late to the conversation today, tell you who you're listening to as part of our panel. Joining me in studio is Siham Samai, director at the Women's Legal Center. We also have Nozuko Kondra and Pauline Perez of the Nonkeba Family Counseling Center with us in studio. And on the line, Claudia Berger, who is a survivor of domestic violence, as well as being a social worker and program director at the NGO Annex, which works in the field of prevention of human trafficking. But Claudia has been sharing, very frankly, her own experiences from victim to survivor working through the system. I'm going to bring in just a moment an additional guest to speak about some of the financial consequences. But just before we get to Robin, Sue asking a question that I think if we could answer, Sue, we wouldn't be needing to have this conversation. Her question on WhatsApp is, why do these men want to control women? Do they feel they are out of control? Nozuko, if we knew what was making men into abusers, one would think we wouldn't have the problem we have with abuse, domestic and otherwise, in this country.
It's an interesting question because, as we have mentioned, there is no profile of an abuser. Everyone can be an abuser. I think at some stage, all of us have passed through issues where we've been affected by issues of domestic violence, personally, or someone we know has been in that situation. So, yes, there's issues of control, there's issues of power, there's issues of anger that are involved in the mind of the perpetrator. And they're doing this because they want to get back at another person. They'd be doing this because they don't know what to do about their time, I might say. Because, like, if you're looking at a person who is well off, by being well off is someone who has a job, who has a house, who has a wife, who has children, and then behind closed doors, then you find out that they are abusive towards their family. They're abusive verbally, physically, and like psychologically. Then you ask yourself what goes through in their mind. You won't be putting blame and saying that it's because the lady provoked her. But they will ask, she asked for it. She provoked me. She doesn't do this for me. She doesn't do this for me. But then there's platforms out there because people know that there's FAMSA, there's Nonkeba Family Counseling Centers that are there to help and assist people into dealing with their issues. We know that sometimes, yes, there's issues of like men also can be in an abusive relationships. But then there is spaces that are opened, options that everyone can go for help if they need someone to listen to them, and then so that they can talk things through. Because sometimes you don't even know if you are still on the right track within even the functions of your family, because the stresses with work, the stresses with the finances, the stresses with managing household, and then you come back home and then you find out the TV is switched off. So there's going to be those issues. So something is going to be triggering. So that's why I cannot say that what exactly causes a person to do this. Mm-hmm. But I know there's studies that have been done which assist with trying to understand what is happening.
Yeah. I wish we could take your comments about provocation and play them for certainly Deputy Minister in our Cabinet who needs to hear them, I think. But that's a conversation for another day. Pauline, we were chatting during the news break about the role of the community here and the importance of the community itself becoming part of the solution, because even beyond the issue of just domestic violence into violence in society at a wider level, it's not a problem that can be solved by the law alone or by Parliament alone, is it?
Absolutely. You can improve the justice system, but perpetrators are not born. I mean, perpetrators are socialized, and there needs to be a community intervention that actually looks at why men behave the way they do in certain societies or in certain communities. And I think that's the missing link. We're concentrating on women alone. we're not looking at men and saying what kind of intervention can we have in terms of men. Also, communities also don't take responsibility for what's happening because we leave certain behaviors unchecked. As a mother, as a woman, as a father, we need to, when something is wrong, we need to say that thing is wrong. But the it's become so blurry in terms of what is right and what is wrong. Some things are blatantly wrong, but people will say, let me choose the lesser of what is wrong, and they make it acceptable. And so it becomes acceptable in society. And I think that we're not challenging that. Communities also, when you talk about communities like in a community like Khayelitsha, some things are not spoken about. The men will say these are things that need to be spoken about amongst men. So everybody keeps quiet about the issues. Everybody's silent about it. They don't challenge it. And that's a major problem, that all of us need to actually start talking about it. Mm. And when our girl children or our boy children say and do things that are wrong, we need to, you know, check them on that, and we need to correct them on that.
And it's not allow it to become normalized.
We must not, and it has become normalized. That's what's so frightening for me. Because it's not just the violence against women and children. It's male violence on male violence as well. So you're dealing with almost a whole community that is traumatized by this violence happening within itself.
Mm. I want to bring in at this point someone with a slightly different perspective of on this conversation. Robin Farrell is a trustee of the First for Women Foundation, which recently carried out a survey speaking to women who had survived and escaped abusive relationships. And Robin, thanks for joining our conversation this afternoon. Welcome to the show. I was really interested reading your findings about what those women had to say about the reasons they stayed for as long as they did, the financial implications of leaving, but also the advice that they shared on what helped them to get out. So let's take a look at a couple of those. I'm interested about the findings, particularly about financial independence. We've spoken during today's discussion about how often it is an economic decision that women feel they can't leave because they can't afford to leave. They can't. They are not income earners themselves. They don't know how to support themselves without that breadwinner. Your survey quite gratifyingly found that a lot of those women were actually able to find their feet and find some financial independence relatively soon after leaving. Tell us more.
That's right. We were very pleasantly surprised because I think traditionally we have thought that women have been unable to leave. I mean, abusive relationships, it's essentially a form of economic slavery. So what we were very pleased to see that 90% of women found financial independence. It did take them a while. It probably took them about a year on average, but anywhere between 3 months and 2 years to find their feet again. But they did find their feet again, and I think that's the message if we could give to people who are currently victims and that they can become survivors and that they can become financially self-sufficient.
A key factor for those who were able to get back on their feet was the role of support structures of other women who were prepared, women in particular, who were prepared to help them, wasn't it?
Well, very much so. And I think I suppose we shouldn't be surprised by that because women do support each other largely. And it was about the people who supported them to leave, their mothers, their sisters, their friends. And I think one of the things that were identified, if women did find themselves in a position where they were being abused, was to build a support system that allowed them to leave and that it supported them once they had left and that kind of reassured them and gave them the confidence to kind of stick with their decision and to know that there was a light at the end of the tunnel, they would find their feet, they would regain their confidence, and they would once again find financial stability and financial security.
Mm. Now, Robin, for those women to get to that point at the end of the journey, it requires taking a decision somewhere further back on the line that I'm going to try to leave and I need to start making preparations to leave.
Correct.
And the women that you spoke to gave some very practical advice about if you've got to the point where you're ready to make that decision, some of the factors you need to consider. Won't you just talk us briefly through those?
Sure. Some of the things that they discussed was researching safe houses. So I think knowing where you're going to go. And planning that, but without kind of over-planning it to the nth degree. Some of the advice that they gave was to keep, for example, evidence of abuse and to not necessarily keep that in your house, to keep that in somebody else's house. To also keep a bag handy with your important documentation in it, your ID document, a passport, if you have it, so that if you do need to leave at short notice, you can grab it and run. And I think also be prepared to leave at any minute. Many of the women said that they had left while the perpetrator was at work, so that they'd found that opportunity then. So I think it was about doing a bit of preparation about what you want to take with you, thinking about the time, and most importantly, knowing where you're going to go. So that when you walk out that door, you have an address, you have a phone number, you have a bit of a plan as to where you can go and as to where you're going to be safe and to where the perpetrator is unlikely to find you, or where you'll be safe if he does come knocking.
Robin Farrell, thank you so much. Some very valuable practical tips there. Robin is a trustee of the First for Women Foundation, which carried out that research with women who had escaped abusive relationships. Pauline, obviously Nonkhebe is one of those places that women can go to, and I know you do a huge amount working with women, getting them back on their feet in terms of new training, in terms of reestablishing a safe place to live and finding a job, etc. I saw you nodding to say sort of in support of what Robin said, that it can be done, and I think it's something that needs to be emphasized to women, that it might seem impossible when you're in the situation, but it can be done, and it can be done relatively quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, we see women on a daily basis who come in and they're really down and out, and they leave confident, and they're able to take care of their children, and they're able to work and be independent. Mm. I think part of the problem, the issue with women is that they struggle to navigate their way through the justice system. So part of what we do, we don't just provide shelter. Part of what we do is that we provide trauma counseling and we provide support to women. So we have every woman who comes through our doors is attached to a social worker who will then support her through the process. Many of our women don't stay, and they almost have to take their children and run. So most of them land up with nothing. And so we've got to assist them in navigating their way through the divorce procedure, also having access to what is rightfully theirs in terms of their home and furniture and access to maintenance, because that's a problem. Men really don't provide support. So even if the Domestic Violence Act does say that a male is supposed to support his wife, even if she leaves, that does not happen. We struggle in terms of that. And so it's a long process, a very long process. We get funded for only 3 months of the person's stay at the center. And normally it takes up to a year or 2 years to actually get that person stabilized psychologically and then get them on their feet and independent. Mm. But we do it. I think that's what's so we do, even if you've got low literacy levels and you've got no job skills training, we're able to do it. I mean, I've seen it happening time and time again.
I've had two survivors who've shared their stories with us briefly on our WhatsApp line, and I just want to read these messages for you. One of them is anonymous, saying, I spent 40 years in an abusive relationship, very hard to deal with, and my children are scarred for life. I have just heard on radio exactly what I experienced. I realized after 40 years, this man will never change, so I packed what I could and I fled. It's been 4 years of peace, but I am still hurting. Why did Mr. Charming to everyone else except me have such a very bad temper? My problem was I didn't tell anyone until the very end. Thank you for being so frank in your description of what you went through, and I'm so glad that you are out of it, and may those 4 years become another 40 years of peace for you. Thank you for that message. Not speaking out, such a big problem. And Claudia, let me bring you back in here, Claudia Berger, on the line. You've spoken already about how often this happens behind closed doors, how society either doesn't know it's going on or chooses to turn a blind eye. How important is it, do you think, for women to firstly speak out about what is happening to them, and secondly, to do what that survivor has just done and share their story and speak about it from outside the other side of the story, as it were? How important do you think that is?
Well, very. I think that a comment that I want to make is that often what women find is when you go and you approach someone, that you get approached with shame-based behavior. And you get told, but you are not this and you are not that, and why haven't you done this and why haven't you done that? Now, that's what you've been exposed to in your marriage already. So then women decide, okay, well, this is not going to work. I already feel as crap as I do. So I can rather stay with the devil that I know. Mm. And that's something I've experienced. I mean, I've approached two of his best friends, and they refused, even though people knew, they saw at parties, they saw at get-togethers what his behavior was. My saving grace was my faith and my church.
Mm. I'm getting that message from several people as well on our WhatsApp line, including Jenny, who's saying, I came from psychological and verbal abuse 20 years ago. I write it down to inferiority and insecurity on his side, but I am thankful that my strong Christian faith strengthened me to get out of that marriage 20 years ago. And today my sons have become successful role models in society. Jenny, thank you for that. That's very different from the previous message, which said my children are scarred for life. Pauline, maybe let's talk about the cycle. We know that often the abusers are themselves victims of abuse at some point in their life. How do we break that cycle?
Well, I think that the abuse in our society at the moment, if I can just talk about Khayelitsha, a lot of our children are experiencing lots of trauma at the moment. And they become adults, they become teenagers, they become adults, and so they grow up with that trauma, and they think it's normal that's how one should behave. It becomes normal. It's been normalized. And so I think that what needs to happen is that society, the community needs to change. The community needs to actually take a stand against how children are raised, what they are exposed to. In Khayelitsha, for instance, families keeping this kind of behavior within families and sorting it out within families, that needs to change. And I think that's the real solution, actually. The real solution is that we actually have to start right from the bottom in terms of family life, how children are socialized, what teenagers are allowed to do and not to do, and also how partners are allowed to behave towards each other. So I think I'm not sure. Sometimes I become quite despondent about it because I think that we've gone too far. We've allowed this to happen for too long, and so turning back the clock, it's almost an impossibility. And so for me, I certainly at our center, what we've done is that we've got an aftercare program where we teach children a value system. I'm not sure what the impact of that is going to be. We've got 130 kids in an aftercare program, and I think it certainly needs to start there. But also we also need to motivate women and encourage women that they can actually take a stance against violence. And so it's very multifaceted. You've got to, within the community, there's lots of things that have to be done. It's about educating people. It's about challenging some cultural beliefs. And that's very difficult. It's very difficult when you've got to, when you're wanting to challenge a patriarchal society. How do you do that? How do you even begin to do that when it's been thousands and thousands of years that people have lived the way that they have? And so it becomes a problem.
Hopefully conversations like this are part of the solution. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us. Claudia Berger, On the Line Program Director at Annex, Pauline Perez and Nozuko Konjwa of Nonkeba Family Counseling Center, as well as Siam Samai of the Women's Legal Center. Thanks so much for being with us today.